Hi there, and welcome back one last time to the shortest history of Britain. In this episode, we reach the end of our journey through the history of Britain with a quick tour of the 1900s. It's a century that we're all most familiar with, and most of us will have indeed lived through some of it, or have parents or grandparents who may have lived through most of it. As the timeline of history progresses, the speed at which advances are made increases. Where in the 1100s or the 1200s there may not have been many great changes to the landscape of the country besides political ones, the cultural and technological advances made over the 1900s set it apart. As many of you will surely be able to testify, the Britain of your own youth couldn't be more different from the Britain of today, and the catalyst and accelerant of that speediest of growth comes from the Britain of the 1900s. But it wasn't an easy place to get to. When we enter the 1900s, the 20th century, Queen Victoria is still sitting on the throne of Britain, though her written instructions for her own funeral had been written for a few years by that time, as she anticipated what was soon to come. The great Victoria died in 1901. She was given a military funeral, as was customary for the head of the army, and the instruction was given that white should be worn, not black. It was one of the largest gatherings of European royalty to have ever taken place. With a reign lasting 63 years and 7 months, she was at that time the longest reigning British monarch and the longest reigning queen in world history. Victoria and Albert's eldest son Edward took the throne and was crowned Edward VII. Edward was the last monarch of the House of Hanover to rule Britain, and as such he was fluent in not only English and German, but also French too, and his focus on international affairs and foreign policy began to join Europe into quite a peaceful place, albeit very temporarily. He visited the other nations and their royalty frequently, creating a great model of royal diplomacy with Britain at the forefront. Indeed, Edward was related to nearly every other European monarch, and he became known as the Uncle of Europe. Kaiser Wilhelm of Germany and Emperor Nicholas II of Russia were both his nephews. Queen Victoria Eugenia of Spain, Princess Margaret of Sweden, Marie of Romania, Sophia of Greece, they were all his nieces. King George of Greece was his brother-in-law, as was King Frederick VIII of Denmark. The monarchs of Portugal, Bulgaria and Belgium were all his cousins. It's said that Edward held them all in the highest regard and loved them all dearly, with one notable exception, Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany, thus wavering somewhat the relationship of Britain and the Germans. This gave Britain this adopted role of the peacemaker, a hegemonic agreement in principle only, and led by Edward VII. One of the greatest achievements of this was to secure a treaty with France known as the Entente Cordiale, an agreement which brought the powers of Britain and France together as allies, marking the end of over 1,000 years of intermittent fighting between the two nations, going back well before either had even been a country in the true sense. Along with agreements with Russia, which formed what is known as the Triple Entente, the three powerhouses joined into an allied force. A similar agreement was reached elsewhere on the continent between Germany, Italy, and the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Britain was engaged overseas in South Africa in the Boer Wars, and in 1902 the Second Boer War came to an end, and there were very obvious failings of which to note for the king. And he used some of the lessons learned on the African continent to reform the British army. He created the Territorial Force, an early incarnation of today's Territorial Army, and the Expeditionary Force, which would head to the continent to aid the French in the event of oncoming war. He also reformed the British Royal Navy, scrapping some of the older ships and vessels, and placing more focus on craft armed with torpedoes and great warring dreadnoughts with huge heavy caliber guns and steam-powered turbine propulsion. On the 6th of May 1910, King Edward VII died in his home and was buried in St. George's Chapel in Windsor Castle. His son George would become King George V the following year in 1911. One of the first major events in history to occur under his rule was the sinking of the Titanic in April of 1912, where 1,503 people died in the North Atlantic Ocean after the ship hit an underwater iceberg about 400 miles south of Newfoundland. Back on dry land, however, George had inherited his throne at a very politically turbulent time, both domestically and abroad. Serious political wranglings and feuds in the Houses of Commons and in the Lords were soon overshadowed by political movements on the continent. Over in Sarajevo, the heir to the throne of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Franz Ferdinand, was assassinated by a Serbian nationalist. The empire blamed the government of Serbia for this action, and Serbia had the military support of Russia. And so the Austro-Hungarian Empire were very reluctant to declare war against such a formidable opponent until they themselves had accused their own ally, which came in the form of Germany. Kaiser Wilhelm II gave his consent, and war began. Those allied to Russia, namely Britain and France, though there were indeed many others, were immediately drawn in to defend their team. The Germans began to fight the war on two fronts, heading east to battle Russia and west to France. Now, this is the shortest history of Britain, and it's very easy to drop into the longest history of the Great War, so we'll have to stick to the key points which affected Britain only and leave you to learn the rest elsewhere. Germany had crossed through Belgium, an independent and neutral country, and thus Britain gave an ultimatum to Germany to withdraw, or war would be declared. Though informally, the truth was more along the lines of entering the war to protect France, as should Germany take control of France, then they would control the better portion of Western Europe, and Britain would be very vulnerable. King George's ultimatum was set to expire at 11 p.m. London time on the night of August the 4th, 1914. It was ignored by the Germans, and the king declared war that night. 4 days later, the Defence of the Realm Act was passed, giving the government wide-ranging powers to help with the war effort. It imposed censorship on some journalists and on letters coming back from the front line, all intended to keep morale at home as high as possible in the face of an escalating world war. Britain had a relatively small army at the time, around 400,000 troops, half of whom were already overseas in Britain's various territories, but the need to grow was vital, and by 1918, the army stood with over 4.5 million men. The navy, on the other hand, was the largest navy anywhere in the world, its strength more than equal to the combined strengths of the next best two navies, incidentally the French and the Russian ones. But Great Britain was, for the first time since the Napoleonic Wars, in danger of attack on its own shores from both naval attacks and from the air too. The Germans fired on Great Yarmouth, Scarborough, Hartlepool and Whitby, all from the sea, albeit with very little impact. From the air, the coasts were hit again by bombers who also reached London before being repelled. On the continent, trench warfare began. Lines of armed men dug into the ground on both sides of the battle. Machine guns were improved upon, and barricades of barbed wire strung across the battlefield made advancing lethal. We saw the introduction here of gas warfare too. Chlorine gas was utilised to horrible effect, and on the Western Front the difficult position and all-round stalemate of the war led to the arrival and introduction of the first tanks. The first tanks developed for the war were from the British and their own engineering minds, but in short time the Germans had developed their own too. In 1916, after the bloody Battle of the Somme, the war was beginning to take a huge toll on the men there. Machine gun rounds were not the only things killing the men, in fact, they were sometimes secondary. Trench foot, the name given to the condition of the feet caused by the constant exposure to the damp and cold, to wet boots and wet socks which could lead to the loss of the limb. Shell shock, lice, trench fever and the flu, another outbreak of the Spanish flu, burns and blindness from exposure to chlorine gas and mustard gas. The combined horrors were taking hundreds of thousands of lives from every force in the war. On the 8th of August 1918, there began a counter-offensive by the Allied troops, known as the Hundred Days Offensive. The battle involved 120,000 British and French troops and over 400 tanks, and was a turning point in crushing the morale and the plans of the German forces to advance any further, pushing them back and breaking open their lines. Just after the battle began, the German general and chief military policymaker Erich Ludendorff claimed that, quote, "We cannot win the war anymore. We've reached the limit of our powers of resistance. This war must end." The Allies continued to fight with the Germans, and the Germans continued to fight back until in 1918 Imperial Germany fell, and the beginning of the Weimar Republic replaced it. In September of that year, Bulgaria was the first to sign an armistice, then Italy requested one, then the Austro-Hungarian force fell. Finally, on the 11th of November 1918, an armistice with Germany was signed in a railroad carriage, and at 11 p.m, the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, a ceasefire came into effect, all but ending what we now know as the First World War. The final casualties of the British Empire stood at 876,084 men, either killed in action, dying as a result of their wounds, or missing in battle. Just after the war, in 1919, there began another war of independence in Ireland. By 1922, a truce was agreed by King George V, who signed the Anglo-Irish Treaty, partitioning Ireland into two, Northern Ireland and the Irish Free State, or Southern Ireland as it was known at the time, long before it were to become a republic. In 1928, King George fell ill with septicemia, and his son Edward took on many of the royal duties in his absence. The following year, he retired to his home in Bognor in Sussex, and it's due to this stay that the town adopted the suffix regis to its name, Latin for of the king. On the evening of the 20th of January, the king was injected, as was his request, with two lethal injections containing morphine and cocaine, and allowed to die painlessly and peacefully in his own bed that night. The news of his passing was prepared for the morning newspapers. The BBC, Britain's national broadcaster, was formed just a few years earlier in 1922. And on the evening of the King's death, or the evening of the announcement of the King's death, which was actually the following night, a live broadcast was put out of a playing of the composition Trauer Music, or Mourning Music, which had been composed in full by the great German composer Paul Hindemith during only the course of that day, and played with the support of the BBC Symphony Orchestra in Queen's Hall in Langham Palace. He was succeeded on the throne by his son, Edward VIII. Little side note here, Edward flew from Sandringham to London for his Ascension Council, marking him as the first ever royal to fly in an aircraft. Now, Edward only reigned for less than a year. His life during that time, and indeed before and after it, causing what can only be described as a scandal. While such things were once accepted by the population, and indeed the royals and politicians too, the times had indeed changed. Edward had been given the lease of Fort Belvedere by his father George, and he used it as a base for which to court and fling with a number of women, and many of whom who were married. After flings with Frieda Dudley Ward and Lady Furness, Edward became romantically involved with the American divorcee, Wallace Simpson. Such concern was there for the couple's not-so-secret affair that the Metropolitan Police Special Branch followed them for some time to ascertain the nature of their relationship. And in 1936, Edward declared his intentions to marry her and was met with widespread condemnation, divorce still condemned by the Church of England. The Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin presented the King with three options. Give up the idea of marriage altogether and move on. Marry the lady against the people and his ministers' wishes. Or abdicate from the throne. Edward saw the first two options as entirely unacceptable and chose therefore to abdicate. On the 11th of December of the same year as his coronation, he announced to the world through the international radio broadcast that he was stepping down from the throne and left the following day for Austria to be with his fiancée. His brother, the Duke of York, took to the throne as King George VI. There were a great number of loose ends to tie up in the messy process of abdication, including the purchases of Balmoral and Sandringham House, which were private properties and didn't pass down to him automatically. George VI's early years were overshadowed by a further threat of war. The new Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, was engaged on the continent with the appeasement of the ruling National Socialist Workers' Party of Germany, now known more commonly as the Nazis. And the new king was loyal to his minister, even inviting him to appear on the royal balcony, an act which had never been seen before. Following the German invasion of Poland in September of 1939, Great Britain declared war again on Germany. With Britain were its territories, colonies, protectorates, and the Empire of India, along with self-governing dominions of the British Empire, namely Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and South Africa, members of the British Commonwealth. At the time, the British Commonwealth was formed of 25% of the world's population and 30% of its landmass. In the Second World War, this equated to nearly 15 million serving men and women fighting the Allied cause against the Axis armies of Germany, Italy and Japan, as well as some more minor powers in the likes of Thailand, Hungary, Finland, Romania and some others. The war, whilst the Second World War, was fought on a far more global scale than the first, with engagements across virtually every continent and every ocean, the exception perhaps being the Americas. In 1940, the Germans were advancing north through France and Belgium, though they were being held back rather successfully by the Allied powers, fighting and pushing against their lines on all fronts. The German Luftwaffe sent its fleet of planes across the waters to Britain on bombing raids in what we now know as the Blitz. They conducted mass raids and attacks on towns and cities and on certain industrial targets on British soil, with the additional aim of drawing the RAF Fighter Command into a winner-takes-all dogfight, an annihilation battle as it's sometimes termed, to wipe out the air command of the British Army. From the 7th of September 1940, Britain was bombed for 56 of the next 57 days and nights. From October it was almost entirely nights. They also targeted Liverpool, Hull, Belfast, Cardiff, Glasgow, Portsmouth, Coventry, Manchester and Sheffield, amongst many others. Over 40,000 civilians were killed during these raids, half of that in London. But the German goal of demoralising the British into surrender, to crush the war effort, to cause so much damage that the funds were not available for war machine production, just didn't materialise. The British didn't falter, and the production of necessary arms, machines and supplies steadily increased instead. It's thought that the more seriously hit towns and cities took only around 10 days or so to recover. The British began countermeasures, simulating towns and factories on the ground with lights in rural areas, drawing the bombers off target. Meanwhile, the British were also in the skies over the Channel, intercepting the bombers en route. The British manufacturer of planes like the Bolton Paul Defiant, faster than the German bombers with 4 mounted machine guns, and then the Bristol Beaufighter with 6 machine guns, a cannon, and a top speed of way over 300 miles an hour, started to turn the Battle of Britain, as it's known, away from German favour. The German attentions were also being drawn elsewhere by the great losses they were facing to the Soviets on the Eastern Front. With most of the world now drawn to battle, fighting for one of the sides, on New Year's Day of 1942, the Allied Big Four, or the Four Policemen as they're sometimes known, namely the leaders of the British Empire, Franklin Roosevelt of the United States, Joseph Stalin of the Soviet Union, and Chiang Kai-shek of the Republic of China, formed the first incarnation of the United Nations. 22 other small governments put their signature to the treaty, all agreeing that defeating Germany was the primary target to achieving peace. Whilst the US and the Soviet Union argued that all-out war on a grand scale was the best way forward, the British put forth that a tactical war against certain German or Axis strengths was a better use of men and supplies, wearing them down and destroying their war effort. The US forces, with the help of the Chinese, Australian, New Zealand forces, began to take back the Pacific and South Asia, and the Soviets pushed Germany back out of Eastern Europe, whilst the Mediterranean was taken from the Italians and a plan to push back into occupied France was formed. On the 6th of June 1944, the Western Allies launched an invasion into northern France, with others attacking from the south. It became known as D-Day, and was largely a great success at getting huge amounts of Allied boots onto the grounds on the French mainland. The French cheered from their German-occupied windows as the troops arrived, and by August, Paris was liberated from Nazi rule with the great help of the French resistance fighters led by Charles de Gaulle. By September, the Germans were pushed back out of southern Europe. By December, the Soviets had moved so far forward that their war on the Eastern Front was now being fought inside German borders, and by the next May, most of southern Asia and the Pacific was returned to the rightful hands from their Axis occupation. On the 30th of April 1945, with Berlin completely surrounded by US and Soviet forces, Hitler committed suicide in his bunker, and 8 days later, the German instrument of surrender was signed. Whilst the war in the Pacific continued for a few more months, it would take the heavy-handed nuclear arsenal of the US to fully resolve, bringing an end to the Second World War. The official count shows 450,900 deaths to the British, which includes from their crown colonies too, of which just over 67,000 were civilian, and the remaining 383,000 were to military personnel. In the aftermath, the newly formed UN agreed a Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and the Allied powers of Britain, France, China, the Soviet Union, and the United States became the permanent members of what is now the UN Security Council, charged with ensuring global peace and security to all nations. In 1947, the Indian Independence Act was signed and agreed, partitioning India into two independent dominions of India and Pakistan, and George VI relinquished his title of Emperor of India, and instead adopted the titles King of India and King of Pakistan. He would keep the title of King of India until India fully realized its independence in 1950, at which point he was recognized by his new title, Head of the Commonwealth, while he remained King of Pakistan until his death. On the 6th of February 1952, King George VI was found dead in his room at Sandringham House in Norfolk, dying of coronary thrombosis, aged just 56. On the 2nd of June of the following year, 1953, his daughter Elizabeth was crowned Queen Elizabeth II, though this was contested somewhat in Scotland and aggrieved many there, as she was indeed the first Elizabeth to actually reign over Scotland. That same year, Elizabeth and her husband Philip, born Prince Philip of Greece and Denmark, and now the Royal Consort and Duke of Edinburgh, left for a 7-month round-the-world trip, visiting 13 different countries and marking the first time that either the monarch of Australia or New Zealand had visited either of those countries. Now we're beginning, or indeed well into, the beginning of the scientific revolution that would lead to some of the greatest advances in science and medicine, and which form the backbone of some of today's studies and understandings. One from this exact time, from this year 1953, was the discovery by British biologist and neuroscientist Francis Crick, along with American student James Watson, of the double helix structure of DNA, now regarded as the first correct model of the structure. On the 28th of February, Crick interrupted the lunchtime patrons at the Eagle Pub in Cambridge to announce that he'd just discovered, quote, the secret of life. 3 years later, Queen Elizabeth opened Calder Hall, the first nuclear power station to provide electricity on a national grid, and 2 years after that, the first motorway was opened at the Preston Bypass, part of what is now the M6 in Lancashire. With just 2 lanes in each direction, and no safety barrier or central reservation, and also no speed limits, and 30 years before the mandatory wearing of seatbelts, it was quite an exhilarating drive for the thousands of drivers who took to the roads. The following year, the first full-length motorway began to open between Watford and Birmingham, though it would soon stretch northwards to Leeds and southwards down to London, and be known through the motorway classification system as the M1. Now, if the 1950s were in black and white, the next decade was in full Technicolor. The 1960s provided a cultural shift across the world and as much in Britain as anywhere else. A culture and a counterculture had taken root in the freedoms of the 50s, and a rebellion was beginning to form in pursuit of peace and love. The Beatles, The Who, The Small Faces all began to shift from teddy suits to rock and roll, bringing with them The Animals, The Kinks, The Rolling Stones, Pink Floyd and The Yardbirds. While similar movements abroad and in the US were reacting to triggers such as the Vietnam War, the rise in Britain of flamboyant fashion, a more open acceptance of sex and drugs and rock and roll festivals was changing the landscape of the country. In 1965, the Labour MP Sidney Silverman, who'd committed himself to the cause of abolishing the death penalty in Britain for more than 20 years, put forth a private member's bill which passed the Commons and then the Lords. The Murder Act of 1965 suspended the death penalty in Great Britain, though not Northern Ireland, for 5 years. And in 1969, Home Secretary James Callaghan brought a motion to make the Act permanent. Northern Ireland, in turn, abolished it in 1971. It brought the death penalty to an end with just a few exceptions: treason, violent piracy, espionage, which were all abolished quite some time later. In fact, treason and piracy only in 1998. Now, in 1971, Britain and Ireland changed their currency system of pounds, shillings and pence to a decimal system on what was known as Decimal Day, the 15th of February. Much of the world had adopted the decimal system for many years. Indeed, it had been proposed in Britain as early as 1824 and the idea rejected. The US had signed the Coinage Act in 1792, bringing their own decimalisation of currency. And finally, the British brought to an end the farthings and shillings and crowns and introduced what is clearly a far simpler, certainly with hindsight, method of counting money. The 60s and 70s saw an increased acceleration of the decolonization of British territories in places such as Africa and the Caribbean. Over that period, there were 20 countries who gained independence from the British Empire, including Nigeria, Cameroon, Tanzania, Botswana and Kenya in Africa, Jamaica, Trinidad and Tobago, the Bahamas and Barbados in the Caribbean, Fiji, Tonga, Nauru, Vanuatu in the Pacific, Yemen, Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar and Bahrain in the Middle East. As Britain's power across the world began to diminish somewhat with the lessening of its territories, it entered the EC, the European Community, in 1973. Now, from the late 1960s, there had been escalating a low-level conflict in Northern Ireland, which would be known as the Troubles. Whilst the two sides adopted the names Catholic and Protestant as their causes, it wasn't indeed a religious war, more an ethnic and nationalistic one. Started by the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association to end discrimination against the Catholic or nationalist minority by the Protestant or Unionist governments, it soon escalated beyond expectation and became the longest ever operation by the British Army to try to find peace. After the Bloody Sunday massacre of 1972, paramilitary organisations became involved, with the IRA and the INLA on the side of the Republicans and the Ulster Nationalists on the other. By the time the Good Friday Agreement was signed in 1998, 3,500 people had been killed, including Prince Philip's uncle, the Lord Mountbatten, who was assassinated in his boat at sea off the coast of County Sligo by members of the IRA. In 1981, Queen Elizabeth's eldest son Charles, the Prince of Wales and current heir to the British throne, married Lady Diana Spencer in St Paul's Cathedral, and they would go on to have two sons, William and Harry. The following year, Britain was again engaged in war overseas after Argentina invaded the British-held Falkland Islands just off the South American coast. The British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, the first female to hold the position in all of its history, headed a crisis meeting and advised the Royal Navy to sail south to engage. A special war cabinet was established with Thatcher dominating proceedings, and the war would continue for 10 weeks before coming to an end in British favour. The Argentinians still maintain that the islands are their own territory, despite the Falkland Islanders being mainly descended from British inhabitants and mostly identifying as British and not Argentinian. As the 1990s began, the great English computer scientist Sir Tim Berners-Lee had brought us the internet, computers were appearing in homes, mobile phones were becoming more common, and the end of the millennium was upon us for only the second time in the entire timeline of this podcast. In 1997, however, there was room for one last heartbreak, as Diana, the Princess of Wales, was killed in a car chase through the streets of Paris. Divorced from Prince Charles and travelling with her partner Dodi Al-Fayed, who was also killed, the consensus is that they were being chased by paparazzi photographers on bikes, and that her Mercedes S-Class lost control in a tunnel just after midnight. Regarded as the people's princess, her passing was greeted with incredible amounts of grief from the British public. Her funeral at Westminster Abbey drew more than 3 million people to the streets, and her close friend Elton John's rendition of Candle in the Wind, recorded in her memory, sold over 33 million units to become the best-selling single since either UK or US single charts had begun 50 years earlier. It's estimated that her funeral was watched on TV by over 31 million people across the UK and by over 2.5 billion worldwide, broadcast in 200 countries in 44 different languages. But as the 1990s drew to a close, it was the fears over the so-called millennium bug which focused our attentions. The members of the European Union, with the exception of a few countries including Britain, adopted the euro as their new currency. Construction started on the International Space Station, The Matrix was smashing the cinema box office, and the future for the next millennium was a highly technological one. So there we are, from the end of the Great Ice Age to The Matrix. That is about as fast as I could have done it. I know so much was missed, especially in this episode when our focus on events is far clearer, but I hope it's given you a better understanding of British history, even from long before there even existed a Britain, or indeed an England, or a Scotland, or an Ireland, or a Wales. Britain has been invaded by the Romans, the Germanic people, the Danes, the Vikings, the Normans, the French and the Dutch, though in turn they've invaded every nation on the planet with the exception of 22 lucky ones, meaning they've invaded nearly 90% of all the countries to exist on the globe. There have been 61 monarchs of England, 50 monarchs of Scotland, though many of these cross over as the rulers of both nations even before the Act of Union. Since then, a further 12 have now ruled over Great Britain as a unified entity. Now, as we step further forward into whatever the future has for us all, I hope that this gives you a little context to what history you may have already known, a better timeline with which to anchor certain events or characters from the past. And more than anything, I hope it's got you interested in the history of our great countries and encouraged you to dig just a little deeper into some of the things we've managed to just skim over in this, the shortest history of Britain.